Okay, it's my honor to invite you to sit in on the third of our faith sessions. This year we began with Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky, moved on to Professor Lauren Schiffman, and it's a delight to have with us Rabbi Dr. Daniel Sperber. And the structure of the faith session is not quite like the other sessions that we do here. It's more of a personal, more of a biographical conversation. We touch on issues that affected the person's life and how they think about faith. Rabbi Dr. Daniel Sperber currently is the Milan Rovin Professor of Talmudic Research at Bar-Ilan University. He's also the Rav of Congregation Menachem Tzion in the Rova in the Old City of Yerushalayim. Dr. Sperber is an expert in many things, among them classical philology, the history of Jewish customs, Jewish art history, Jewish education, Talmudic studies, of course. He was born in 1940 in Glych Castle in Wales, actually, where he was there for a short time, really just as a baby, and then moved on, I believe, to Manchester, was it? Yeah, moved on to Manchester, and eventually studied and received smicha at Yeshivat Kol Torah in Israel, and earned a PhD from UCL, from University College London, in the Department of Ancient History and Hebrew Studies. He's probably in some ways best known for his monumental 8-volume now work, Minhagei Yisrael, which is really considered a classic, and he received Israel's highest award, the Israel Prize, in 1992. In Minhagei Yisrael, he examines the character and evolution of Jewish customs and their rationale. And his studies include examination of halachic and minhagic foundations of many things, including the role of women in Judaism, which we'll talk about a bit later. He's been a participant in conferences of JOFA, the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance, and written extensively on the topic of inclusion of women in certain ritual services. He has a new book, which came out in Hebrew, Darcha Shel Halacha, Kriyat Nashim B'Torah, Prakim B'Medinut, Psika, translated approximately Women Reading the Torah, A Case of Psika Policy. On a personal note, he's married to Hannah, who's originally of Highland Park in Illinois, and the two of them now have 10 children, and they live in the Jewish quarter of the Old City of Yerushalayim. Please welcome Rabbi Dr. Daniel Sperber. Let's talk a little bit about your growing up, which I take it really was in England in your early youth. And I'm wondering, what was Judaism, what was faith like in your house? We'll talk specifically in a few minutes about some major figures in your life, your parents, your grandfather especially seems to be a towering figure. But I'm wondering, what was the atmosphere for you growing up in terms of how you felt Yahdut, how you experienced it?
Well, first of all, I think I have the unique situation that I was actually born in a castle. And I was the only child born in that castle. I mean, there may have been somebody born in 1700 or something. And my parents formed a refugee center, and my father brought over 600 young Kindertransport children, who most of whom afterwards were orphans whose parents had perished in the Holocaust. And he managed to get this castle from a lord, an English lord, Lord Dundonald, who was not living in Wales at the time, but in London, in the House of Lords most of the time. And my parents got the castle, and it was quite a gaunt castle. You know, there was no electricity, and you had to bring up water from a well. There was no heating. There were cellars, and there were secret passages. And now I had no knowledge of this. I was too small, but when I was 19, I went back, and it was a stately house, and they didn't want to let me in until I showed my birth certificate. And they were absolutely amazed. They thought it was a forgery. But I explained to them I was born in this castle. So I was brought up in a house which was in an atmosphere, first of all, which was, let's call it an atmosphere of chesed, where my parents were we engage in helping people in all sorts of ways. And then afterwards we moved to the smallest town, city in the world, which was just a short distance away from the castle, called St. Asaph. It was a city because it had a cathedral, but it only had one street and perhaps 30 houses. But it was a city of St. Asaph, and that's where we, when we had to move out of the castle, we moved into this city for a short time. Then my father and my mother went to Manchester, where he was head of a sort of a yeshiva called Merkaz Limud, which was for, again, mainly for these orphan children. And it, I was brought up in these different hachshavot, which were centers for the kinder transport, these German refugee children who were trained afterwards to go to Eretz Yisrael. And then in 1948, 1949, most of them went off to Israel, and they found their way into the different kibbutzim, such as Lavi, Saad, etc. So the house was always a house full of atmosphere of people that had to be helped. And from my earliest days, I remember Suda Shlishit on Shabbat was a big table with lots and lots of people. And I used to sing Mizmor LeDani, Mizmor LeDani, because I didn't know it was Mizmor LeDavid, and my name is Danny. And sometimes I used to sit under the table, I remember. It was very, but the house was a house where people were trying to help people. My father, my mother, my whole family was a house of tremendous amount of chesed. And it was a house where people used to come in all the time, and there was no, everybody was accepted. There were no barriers. And even later on, my father, Alav HaShalom, had a shiur. He had a few shiurim, one in the office where he worked when he was in London, and one in the house on Tuesday night, to which men and women, religious and non-religious, would come, a shiur in Tanakh usually. And I think that he had a profound influence upon the reform movement in London, because the head of Leo Beck College for many, many years was a Talmid Mufak of my father, and it must have been influenced by him. And so the house was a house which was completely open to all people, and it was a house of learning. There was no wasted time. When there was spare time, then we would learn. He would learn with my brother, with my sister, Aleha Shalom. And if somebody would come into the house when we were learning, we wouldn't stop learning. He would just invite them to sit down, tell my mother to bring a cup of tea, and invite him to sit down and learn. And we had, when we were in London, we had a neighbor in the same street as us who was a Scottish Presbyterian priest called Father Strachan. And I remember that on one occasion we were learning together Gemara, learning Masechet Sanhedrin, and Dr. Strachan came in. His son and I went to the same school, a non-Jewish school. He came in to discuss something about the school, and he never got an opportunity. My father said, sit down and join us for this Gemara shiur. And for the next hour, he sat there and he joined in. So that was the form of the atmosphere. The atmosphere was one of great openness, of learning, discussing. Everything was discussable. There were no things that you couldn't talk about. And it was also a multilingual house, because my mother spoke some seven languages, or my father spoke also seven languages, but not the same ones. He spoke Hungarian and she spoke Russian. He spoke Ukrainian and he spoke another one. So people would come in and I would hear Yiddish and German and Hebrew, and my mother tongue was Hebrew. We spoke Hebrew at home, and all sorts of languages. And it wasn't just a matter of many languages; it was a matter of many cultures and many sort of world views. As I said, men, women, religious, non-religious. And so that was the sort of the atmosphere of the house. We moved to Manchester, to London. My father was a rabbi in a shul and also in charge of the Sochnut Torah education department. And there too, there were shiurim in the office, and people used to come all over from the city of London to hear his shiurim. So it was a house of learning, and it was a house of great openness, and it was a house where everything could be discussed. Now, my earliest memories are memories from the war. You know, I remember I slept in what was called a table shelter. Table shelter was a table like this made out of metal with a metal reshet. Netting, metal netting around three sides, and my brother and I would sleep in it so that if a bomb would hit the house, we would survive. And those are my sort of the memories of the war. I remember the shriek of the doodlebugs, the V2s, the bombs coming. And so we lived in, there was a time of great tension and blackouts when you couldn't open the blinds over the doors, and so that no light should come out. You couldn't go out at night. But there was no fear. It's interesting, the house next door to us was hit directly by a bomb. Our house had many, many cracks and so on. But somehow there was no fear. It was a house in which there was always confidence, let's say, emunah b'Hashem, if we want to put it in faith terms, even during the war, even during the blackest of periods. And then I remember also during the War of Liberation, when I was also a young boy, and we used to listen to the radio every day. We used to sit huddled around the radio and listening to how many people had been killed in Palestine during the fights, etc., etc. And at the same time, there was no pessimism. There was no despair. We always felt a tremendous degree of confidence that we would get out of it, we would come out of it all right. And we were brought up with the complete and absolute knowledge that we were not going to live in England and we would only live in Israel. It was just a matter of time when it became possible. And so the house was a house where there was a true unstated, it wasn't something that one talked about, it was just taken for granted that you believed in Chasdei Hashem. In the same way as you did Chesed for others, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu does Chasadim Itanu, and somehow or other things would work out. I don't know how realistic it was at the time, but that was the atmosphere of the house. So that's to give you some sort of background.
Your grandfather, I think it's your mother's father?
Father's father.
I want to give you a quote about your grandfather from your father that I thought was fascinating. Dr. Sperber's grandfather was a follower of the Chatam Sofer, and Dr. Sperber's father, in his description of his grandfather, wrote as follows, quote, "He had the quality of a sage in that he was hard as iron when necessary. He was an expert judge in communal matters and property disputes, and he would be invited to sit on a court as an arbitrator or as the chief judge in complicated cases, both public and private. And these adjudications would be tempestuous, and some would try to influence him in various ways or refuse to accept his decision. I recall an instance when he had issued a judgment in a case involving a huge amount of money, and they had tried in various ways to stop him. And he said, 'Why did they choose me to chair this court? If because of my learning in Torah, there undoubtedly are those more learned. If because of my expertise in worldly matters, there undoubtedly are those more expert. I have one quality. I fulfill the pasuk, fear no person, for the judgment is God's.'" And it's interesting when I hear what you were saying in your speech before about the idea of, you know, Piskei Halakha having to somehow come out of a place that's not fearful. I'm wondering if your grandfather's influence was marked there.
My grandfather, Alav HaShalom, was a member of Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. He was a member of Agudat Yisrael. he lived until 1949, he lived in Romania. He was the rav of a large Jewish center in Brasov, and there were two famous rabbis in Romania at the time, the Todorov and the Brasovorov, and they basically were the leading gedolim in Romania, and they were the adjudicators in all the major problems. At that time, there were many conflicts between the different chassiduyot, between Vizhnitz and Satmar, etc., in the north, in the area of Siget. And the adjudication was very difficult, and It's true that he was fearless, except for the fear of God. My father, on the other hand, was a member of Mizrahi, a very active member of Mizrahi, and in a sense had strayed from the path of Agudat Yisrael. And he also showed great independence of thought and independence in his Piskei Halakha. He was considered the Rav of Bnei Akiva and of Torah Avodah, of those youth movements during the Second World War. There were very, very many difficult problems that had to be dealt with. There were questions of young men going off to the war, requiring a Kiddushin al Tnai or a Get al Tnai, which was not normally done by the Beit Din of London, and he did it, and so on. So he inherited much of this sort of characteristic of being true to himself and to his own ideological and halachic understanding of the situation. In that sense, they were very similar, and they were very close. Even though they lived apart, they were very close in feeling, and they both had a tremendous respect for one another and a deep love for one another. Even though my father lived in London much of the time that my grandfather was already in Eretz Yisrael, and they only saw each other on not very often. But so both of them, in a sense, inculcated in me, certainly, this feeling that a person has to be true to themselves and has to be outspoken in those things that he thinks are important and that he thinks they're right, and where he thinks that he can possibly, you know, being optimistic, have some sort of a positive influence. My grandfather, Alav Shalom, after the war, he with the Todorov had to deal with the massive problem of the women that came back from the camps and who were all... Well, the problem was, what was their halachic status? How they'd be treated in the camps, whether they'd been raped, whether they could remarry, who they could marry, etc. And all the agunot who had lost their husbands. And there was a sort of an almost communal psak halacha given by the Brashevorov, the Todorov, which was afterwards countersigned by all the major rabbanim in Romania, which basically found a solution for all these women that came back from the camps. In other words, it was tremendous heteragunot and other types of problems. This also took a great deal of courage, because it was by no means an easy subject to find a solution to, but he felt that halachically it was justified and it was absolutely necessary, and he received the support from the Gedolim of the time. I knew him only in his old age, in the last 5 years of his life, when I was studying in Kol Torah. You mentioned I studied under Shlem Zalman Rohrbach, but I got my smicha from my grandfather, Alav Shalom, and then afterwards I was in Yeshivat Hebron. At that time he was already very sick, and he was bedridden. But people used to come in all the time, and they used to ask questions, and he would answer the questions. He couldn't hold a sefer. He was in bed, he was too weak. So he would learn. He would learn by heart. He would learn by heart Shas, Shulchan Aruch, Rambam, all by heart. He had fantastic memory. And the only things that he actually held were a small siddur when he davened, and the Chumash and Rashi for Shnai Mikra Vechatargu. That's the only... And we used to have to carry him out to wash him, to take him to the toilet, etc., because he was too weak. But he had sparkling eyes, and he could speak. Although he was weak, he would speak to anybody. And it's very interesting. It was mentioned on both by Dr. Shapiro and by Dr. Kellner that the Rambam writes in such a way that he can be understood by different people at different levels through the same text. One of the things that always astounded me was how my grandfather, Alav Shalom, would be in the company of great Talmidei Chachamim. Many times Moitzat Gedolei HaTorah used to take place in his house because he was too weak to go out. And the Vizhnitzer Rebbe and the Gerer Rebbe and the Belzer Rebbe would come in. They would sit around, and I was a young boy. I used to sit at the side to make sure he was okay. And then in the middle, a woman would come in with a very simple shaila, and he would answer her, and they would understand the psak halacha at a completely different level than she would. So he also had this most remarkable method, technique, ability to speak one sentence which could be understood at multiple levels. But what was most amazing was that he would give equal regard and care and attention to a simple woman, to a simple housewife that came in, even in the presence of these great Gedolim. And the Gedolim were aware of the fact, and they appreciated it. And because he had to be respectful for them at the same time, he would formulate it in such a way that they would understand what he was saying at a totally different level. So, the things that I remember very strongly from him was the need to try to understand each individual person that comes and give them your personal attention and make them feel that you're regarding them as an individual, as a person with his own importance and his own status. And at the same time to be able to take into account the environment in which you're found. And the two perhaps most dominant personalities in my life, besides my mother, who was a tzaddeket, who was a person of tremendous love and support, but from a point of view of learning and a point of view of the derech ha-halacha, I learned with both my father, alav ha-shalom, and my grandfather, alav ha-shalom. He was the one that tested me for smicha, grandfather, and I think I got a tremendous amount from each of them. In many ways, though, they were different people and they had different ideologies, they had many ways the same sort of characteristics.
Just to add very briefly to that, Dr. Sperber's mother, Rabbanit Miriam Sperber, wrote a book, Misipurei HaSavta, Grandmother's Stories, and in that book she has a story here about a rock that had been thrown through Dr. Sperber's grandfather's window. What happened was that his grandfather revoked a kashrut from a butcher shop, and when the rock was thrown, there was a baby there, and the rock came very close to the baby and almost injured the baby. So Dr. Sperber's father asked his grandfather, is it worthwhile being a rabbi, dedicating many years to a community, and then have a rock thrown through your window? And his grandfather responded, it is certainly worthwhile. Know, my son, that a rabbi who has no disputes, who is under no pressure, is no rabbi. And a rabbi who submits to that pressure is no human being. So, clearly, a remarkable person. I wanted to pick up on a comment you made earlier.
Let me just tell you that little baby, my cousin, Shendi, is the wife of the Vishnitsa Rebbe.
That's good that the rock missed. You said, here, sort of Derek Agav, that you went to non-Jewish school. I'm wondering about your schooling. Was sort of Torah education at home, or did you eventually switch into a Jewish system?
No, I went to what we call a primary school. I guess that's a junior school, or whatever you call it, till the age of, which was a Jewish school, which was founded by my uncle. And I was not a good student. I spent most of the time in the corner or outside in the corridor. I was very talkative. And I had an excuse. My mother at the time was suffering very seriously for tuberculosis, TB, and she was in hospital in Switzerland, in Arosa, in Switzerland, just near Davos, for 2 years, and I didn't see her. And so I was living with an aunt, and I guess that's the sort of psychological excuse I have for having been a naughty boy. But then afterwards, just before we, in England, I don't know whether you have it here, we have an 11-plus examination that you have to take in order to go to high school, to grammar school. So 6 weeks before, my father took me to a private teacher. It was a Sephardi Jew, Mr. Hadida, and he taught me everything that I should have learned in 6 years, in 6 weeks. And I passed the exams and I got into what's called a grammar school, which is, I guess, a high school, which had about 30% Jews and about 60% non-Jews, but it was an Anglican school. In the morning there was a chapel, but not like a chapel here, a real chapel, with an organ and morning services, but the Jews didn't have to go. We had our own little services. It was a very good school. There were excellent teachers, very mixed lot. One of them, for instance, taught us Russian, and we discovered afterwards he was a communist. And we had a classicist who taught us Latin and Greek, who had been the champion boxer in the British Navy during the war. And so it was quite a. And we had also another fellow who taught us literature, who had been in the Navy in the war. We had a very interesting group of teachers, and we had two Jewish teachers, both of whom were completely ignorant of anything Jewish. They were both, one was a handicrafts teacher and the other was a history teacher. Both very, very positive people. And I was given complete freedom because I jumped two classes and I did more subjects than were possible. And so really school for me was wonderful, because I didn't have to go to class. And I sat in the library and did whatever I want, and I painted. I was painting at the time, and I had a key to the school. I could go at night and paint for as long as I wanted.
How old are you when you're
between the ages of 11 and 16. And at the same time, when I came home, which was usually at about 4:30, till 7 or 8 at night, we would learn with my father. Shabbat, we would learn. Sunday, we would learn. And I learned a tremendous amount. And then when I finished school, I finished early. I got into college, to university, into Oxford and Cambridge and London. But nobody would accept me because I was too young. So I went actually for a short time to Paris to do art. I got a scholarship in an art school. And it was great fun. But really, I was too young. And I realized that it wasn't the right place for me. So then I went to Yeshiva, to Kol Torah. It was quite a move from the left bank, from the Rive Gauche. I remember I lived in a place, in a little attic, in a place called Rue Lachat Kipesh. And I used to go out to Les Halles, which at that time existed as the place where you where they used to deliver the fruits and the vegetables for the shops, the wholesale place, wholesale market. And at about 5 in the morning, you could go and you could pick up what was left over, and that was free. Good vegetables, good fruit, so it didn't have to cost anything, so I could live very cheaply. Vegetarian, so that's all I needed. But this really wasn't the sort of life for an Orthodox young person. And then I went to Yeshiva, to Kol Torah, and then to Hebron. And then I learned, and so my learning came firstly from my father, Alav HaShalom, and then when I was in Israel, I studied for a year under the Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Zichrono Livracha, which was a tremendous chut, and I also learned with my grandfather. And then I moved to Hebron, and in Hebron there was one Rosh Hashiva who for me was, again, the person that was of great influence, and that's Rav Avraham Falbstein, Zichrono Livracha, who was a mensch, and whom you could talk to, and who was open, as opposed to the other Rosh Yeshiva, who may have been great Talmidei Chachamim, but they lived in a completely different world. Chaskel Sarna was, again, one of the most Gedolei Torah, great people, but there could be no relationship between a young 16, 17-year-old and then one of the Gedolei Ador, but Rav Avraham Falbstein you could talk to. And I had private shiurim with two or three of us. And it was very interesting. I was in a room in Yeshivat Hebron upstairs, and there were three of us. One was Rav Shlomo Zalman Havlin, who's now a professor at Bar-Ilan, who just retired. We were in the same room, and he was older than me and brighter than me and a bigger Talmid Chacham. And he eventually worked his way into the university system. And the other was a young man who passed away recently called Paris, who was the son of the Rosh Hashiva of Yeshivat Tel Aviv, in Tel Aviv. And he had excess books under the pillow where he used to learn to do the exam, the British matriculation exams externally. And eventually he studied economics and taught economics at Machon Lev. So there were three of us who were oddballs. And I have a wonderful story that I have to tell you about Havlin. Havlin's a brilliant scholar and has published many books. And I remember one summer day, it was a small room and each one of us had a sort of a cupboard. And one day he came back with a big bundle which he put on top of his metal cupboard. And we said, "What is it?" And he said, "I've bought umbrellas. I'm going to make money." They then developed umbrellas where you press the button and they opened up. This was a big chidush. He said, "I buy it in the summer cheap, I'll sell it in the winter and make money." Expensive. He's going to make money for himself. Of course, all the bocholim from the yeshiva came in to see this new thing, and they all started playing with it, and then they did sword fencing, and in a short time they were all broken. So that was his sort of money-making attempt, and then he went back to learning. So the people that I learned with were each one sort of added a different facet to my style of learning or my style of thought, and somehow I found that as a posek, when I had a difficult question and I needed a psak halacha, I would go to Shlomo Zalman Urbach, zichrono livracha, who was a remarkable person and who had a tremendous degree of sensitivity and compassion and was, of course, baki b'chol chadrei HaTorah. And when he went, I really felt kiyatom.
Perhaps you can talk about that a little further, your relationship with him. Because you've spoken about him many times, actually, in different contexts. What specifically would you say was the nature of your relationship?
The nature of a relationship is always difficult when there's a young person and when there's a gdol ador. Normally, you don't have access to these people. But as I had actually learned in his shiur for 1 year, and he saw me more or less daily, weekly, and we would talk in lernen, as they call it, in the yeshiva world. Afterwards, when I was no longer in the yeshiva, or when I went to Hebron, if I had a problem or I had a question, he was my address. He was the person I would go to. And I would go to his house in Shari Chesed, and you would find him after Shachris, and he was very, very accessible. There was no difficulty. It's not like the situation, for instance, at the moment with Rebbe Yoshev, where you can't get to him. You have to go through a whole series of people, and you can never actually talk to him directly anymore. He's protected. Rav Shlomo Zalman was always there for you. You could always talk to him. You could talk to him either in his house or in the shul, or you could talk to him in the yeshiva. And you knew that when you spoke to him, he was paying attention to you. And he was feeling the sort of feelings that you had. I mean, one doesn't go to a gdol ador with a question about a simple question. You go when there's a serious question, when there's a question where there's not an easy answer, where there are difficult alternatives, and where you don't feel confident that you have the, that you can be responsible. And they're not my questions necessarily, the questions that were brought to me. But he was always there, he was always available. And it wasn't a telephone conversation. It was a conversation that was eyeball to eyeball, face to face. He had, you've probably seen pictures of him in these hagiographic books. he had a kikaran o panav. He had radiance. He had an aura. And the aura was an aura of goodness, of ziskite. It's very difficult to express these things. But when you went to him, you felt that here was a person that was really radiating goodness, radiating wisdom, and radiating sensitivity and compassion. His Piskei Halakha are very, very innovative. Not all of them were accepted. And those of you who use his forum, and nowadays they've been filtered, and they've been presented by the next generation, and therefore you don't really get the feel of them. But if you heard him speak and tell you what to do, I'll give you a simple example. There was a situation where a certain organization was having weekly evenings for Baalei Tshuva. They would invite them, and they would give them light refreshment and entertainment, and there was music, and there was a certain amount of dancing, and, you know, sort of Hasidic movement and jumping about. And it perhaps 30 or 40 of these young people would come regularly, and they came from different streams of Judaism, and they were being drawn into an Orthodox circle in this fashion. And when it came to the time of Sfirat HaOmer, there was a question whether these activities could continue, because these were with music, and these were with dancing, and so on and so forth. And I was asked by the person organizing it to go to Rav Shlomo Zalman to ask him. And I went and I explained the situation to him and said, "Why did you ask me? You could have answered yourself. Of course it's permitted." It was so simple and so straightforward. And I know perfectly well that had I gone to others, I would have got a completely different answer. But there was a sort of naturalness in his replies. It sort of came easily. You felt that there was the whole body of wisdom and understanding behind them.
You obviously moved into more academic circles. You went to do your degree at UCL. I'm wondering, was it unusual for someone in your family or your circle to go for a doctorate, and what sort of precipitated that for you?
That's a little complicated. I don't even know myself. What happened was when I was young, I painted a great deal. I even exhibited in something called the Junior Royal Academy. Got prizes, and that's the reason that I got also a scholarship to go to France. And when I was in yeshiva, I drew pictures and I painted, and I even supported myself, sort of. I used to sell things. And when I got back to London, after several years in yeshiva, I decided that painting and art, for me, was an all or nothing. It would have to be all-consuming. I couldn't do anything else. And therefore, I felt that I couldn't continue in this path, because I couldn't stop doing all the other things that interested me, which was Limud Torah, etc. So I decided to make a compromise and to learn art history. Art history was something that was between practicing art and between learning history, which I found was very interesting, and I was particularly interested in Jewish art history, which didn't exist hardly as a subject at the time. And the place where I learned, I was the only Jew there, the Courtauld Institute of Art. It was a wonderful institution, headed by Sir Anthony Blunt, who was afterwards found to be one of the great spies. He was also a homosexual. We knew that. He lived on the top floor with a friend. But he was a wonderful art historian, and he was the keeper of the Queen's art collection. And so we had access to art and to... Anyhow, this was a sort of an ideal situation for me. But then afterwards, while I was doing this, I became aware of the fact that the way we learned to look at things visually opened up to me completely new ways of looking at historical artifacts. And I first published an article on the history, my first article was published on the history of the menorah, in which I tried to analyze it from an art historical point of view and showed what had happened to the menorah and the Arch of Titus. And that sort of drew me even further into the field of history of the Second Temple and the Talmudic period, because obviously I was going to use the information that was available to me from rabbinic texts, which was not available to art historians. At the time, there weren't virtually no Jewish art historians that also had learned in a proper yeshiva background. And I knew Greek and Latin because we started learning it at the age of 11 in school. So by the time we finished school, we could really read fairly easily. And that sort of almost, without my being aware of the fact, drew me into ancient history, and I was invited to do a doctorate in the Department of Ancient History at University College London. The person that encouraged me was the late Professor Weiss, a very tragic character who wrote the classic work on Reb Nachman of Bratslav. He was a tortured individual, which suits studying. Yes, yeah, which suits somebody to study Reb Nachman, and he was a historian of Hasidism. But he was very influential in the Department of Jewish Studies in University College, and he made a shidduch between the department. There wasn't a Department of Jewish Studies; there was a Department of Hebrew Studies, because there was nothing, there was no theology there, because University College was founded by Jeremy Bentham, who they wouldn't permit any theology in an academic institution. So there was a Department of Hebrew Studies, and it was very good. It had some very important teachers, Professor Stein, Alav Shalom, Professor Wieder, Shimon Abramsky. These are names that you probably don't know. It was the son of Dine Abramsky. And he made a shidduch with the Department of Ancient History, and there was a towering scholar, who was a major ancient historian called Professor Arnaldo Monmiliano. Arnaldo Monmiliano was a Jew who one day, when I didn't turn up for his class, said, "Sperber, where have you been?" And I said, "It was Yom Kippur." And he said, "Oh, I forgot." He didn't forget, he didn't know. And over the years, actually, he became much more positive, and he became afterwards a member of the Board of Governors of the Hebrew University, and he became much closer. He was a towering scholar, and he was the person that under whom I did my doctorate, which was on Jewish subjects. It was on the economic currency problems in Eretz Yisrael during the period of the Talmud. So this was a sort of, and it dealt with coins, and coins have pictures on them, so that had to do with art history. So the whole thing somehow, in a very peculiar way, coalesced. And it wasn't something that I'd sort of worked out at any time. It sort of happened.
Ida Rappaport was here in December, and she also ran with Professor Weiss and said he was a remarkable teacher, if not tortured as well. Did you feel attention from someone from yeshiva background doing that kind of work? Because I know later you moved even further into sort of scholarly considerations of Talmudic material and halachic material. Or did it seem like a natural progression for you?
No, quite the contrary. I thought that this was a real challenge. It was a challenge of trying to use rabbinic sources coupled with classical sources and archaeological sources to write social and economic history in a way that had not been done in the past, because in the past the classicists couldn't read a Talmudic text and the Talmudists couldn't read a Greek text, and there was whole areas which were not available to them, to both of these people, because they didn't know anything about archaeology. And this, I felt, was an ideal way of really forging a new sort of direction in this area of historical research. And I afterwards published several books which I tried to demonstrate this sort of combination of different disciplines, which I think enriched our knowledge. I would say more than that. I think that for the historian of that particular period, they got new insights into economic history of the time. And for the Talmudists, they would now be able to understand sugyot in the Talmud, which were completely incomprehensible beforehand. I mean, they could understand perhaps the legal aspects of them, but at a technical level, but not the inner understanding of the svarot, which were totally dependent upon economic circumstances. The whole sugya of azahav, koneh, akesev, etc., doesn't make any sense if you don't know about the coinage and about the economic situation. So I felt that this was a sort of call it science clarifying Talmudic text.
Do you feel that this kind of study, obviously not at the highest level, would be a good thing to incorporate in, you know, Talmudic education, even in younger levels?
In the yeshiva world, when people studied in yeshivot, let's say they were learning Masechet Kiddushin, and they got to a certain place in Masechet Kiddushin, they used to jump over a daf or so because it was dealt with what we call realia talmudit, with everyday life issues, which they wouldn't be able to understand. When they learned Masechet Shabbat, and they were learning about how a house was built and how a door swiveled and about the door threshold, they also would jump over it because they wouldn't be able to understand it and visualize it and conceptualize it. Nowadays, the illustrated volumes and this, which are being published by the Daf Yomi people and by Ma'orot HaDaf HaYomi, etc., most of which I think are completely incorrect because they don't have the sort of background knowledge that they require. But at least they try to make these things understandable. So I think that nowadays there's a general understanding that a great deal of Talmudic material can be better understood and more appreciated and when it's fit into a sort of real-life context, a Sitzin-Leben context. And in that sense, I think, yes, I think it is important. But of course, it has to be presented in a much simpler way, not in the sort of academic jargon that I deal with, which is incomprehensible, except perhaps to the one or two readers or reviewers that read my books.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the project that you've been doing for some years at Bar Ilan, which is just an enormous project. I think you have, is it 1,200 people who are currently learning in the program?
Yeah, we have in Bar Ilan an institution which we call the Institute of Advanced Torah Studies, the Machon HaGavoa LeTorah, which has a kolel of, or a Beit Midrash as we like to call it, of some 350 students, male students, and a Midrashah of some 920 female students, the largest Midrashah in the world. And they study half a day Torah studies in a traditional fashion, and not credit-bearing, but Torah Lishma, for those students that want to continue learning after they've finished their Hesder Yeshiva or after they've come out of the Midrashot and they want to continue learning. And I am now the president for the last 4 years, the president of this institution, which is within the university, but it's sort of semi-autonomous. It's not an academic framework. I moved out of the academia now and I deal with this subject. We also train rabbis. We have a program in which we train the students to do to take the examinations of the rabbinate at all levels, that is to say at Rav Shruna, district rabbi, Rav Ir, city rabbi, and Dayanut. Most of those who have qualified for Dayanut also have doctorates, and they're doing their doctoral program at the same time, so they're enormously intelligent. They're the cream of the students, in my opinion. They're intensely motivated. And of course, they will never be appointed as dayanim in any Beit Din of the Rabbanut. That's very clear. But they may function as dayanim in independent Bate Din, and there are independent Bate Din in certain areas of halakha in Israel. And we also have a practical rabbinics program for those who have just taken the paper qualifications, they've done the examinations, they have no idea how to be a rabbi, they wouldn't know how to deal with mediation, with counseling, with rhetoric, how to give a good shiur, how to give something that's meaningful, and how to listen to people, and how to assess the sort of questions you have to deal with. We teach them also how to give piskei halacha in a much more human fashion. And we do that by giving them real questions which come from outside, complex questions, and we ask them to write a tshuva. Then they discuss it in a group. Each one deals with one particular question. And then it's gone over by the Rosh Beit Midrash, Rav Katz, who's a rabbi of a large shul and also a member of the Beit Din in Ramat Gan, and Rav Ariel, who is the Rav Rashi of Ramat Gan, a person of enormous experience in halakha and a very positive person. And then they discuss it together and they rework it. And in this way they learn how to deal halakha lemaaseh with difficult halakhic problems. And we also have special programs for the women. We teach them how to be counselors for kalot, for young brides and so on and so forth. So we have a variety of different programs. And now this last, a year ago, we opened a new program for students who come from a non-religious background, a completely chiloni background, and we call it Bereshit. And we have admitted them to the Beit Midrash. They now learn in a Beit Midrash atmosphere. More senior students, they are their chavrutot. They also have special introductory lectures, which are not given by the Ramim, but by senior students, usually doctoral students, both men and women. We started with 30. We now have 70. Next year, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, if we find the funding, we'll increase the number. Everything has to be funded. So the whole idea, from the time that I moved into the Machon, the idea is that it just shouldn't be a sort of a haven for the students that want to study in the university and also to continue learning. But since there is this tremendous human resource of these remarkable students, both from the point of view of their academic qualifications, their intelligence, but also their tremendous motivation, we felt that they should also have an influence on the campus and on the surrounding area, and an influence on Klal Yisrael eventually. And that's why we want to produce rabbis who will be academically qualified, will be halachically qualified, will be able to talk to people with professional background. They will have their own professionals, so they won't be totally dependent upon, for their livelihood, upon the synagogue or upon the... And one of the things that's very clear is they must not be appointed by a moitza datit. They must be completely independent of any political entity. And we're placing them in a number of independent communities, congregations, and Baruch Hashem, they're very successful. And we hope that over the next decade or so, if we can produce even 30 or 40 such rabbis in different congregations throughout the country, they will constitute models, and more congregations will take on that model and will create an independent rabbinate. Because as you probably heard from things that I've said and other people said, one of the things that is so disappointing for us is the state of the present rabbinate in Israel. We feel that it's not up to standard and it's politicized, and many of the rabbis who are appointed by the Moetzot that they don't really have an independent stance. They have to take the party political line, and therefore it's very important to, as it were, privatize the rabbinate. So this is something that we're trying to do, and God willing, if we're successful, we'll have a measure of success and perhaps a measure of influence on the atmosphere and on the status of the rabbinate in general.
I want to move into the last stages of our talk, and obviously there's an interest in your involvement in women's issues. When you spoke at Jofa a few years ago, you said that changes happen continually, that change is more accepted when it occurs organically, step by step, slowly, free of undue aggressiveness. And you pointed out that there's thousands of women that are now studying Torah and Talmud in Israel, the U.S., Europe, Canada. There are rabbinic Torah notes. There are women in communal positions, even though the Rambam says that such women can never get halachic authority. And all this, you said, has taken place in one generation, and you believe that this community that has made that changes has done so from proper motives and will be inside the consensus, will not be outside the consensus, and will not be considered non-orthodox, and so on. So that's rather, that's a sort of quasi-optimistic view, a hopeful view, and I'm wondering how you feel at this moment about the future of women in these situations in terms of Limudei Torah, and obviously in more roles of communal responsibility, how you think that will play out in Israel, how you think that will play out in North America. I mean, I'm not sure which scene, you know, you feel you want to speak about.
Let me just give you some background why I got into this. There was an article published in the Ada Journal some years ago by Rabbi Mendel Shapiro on Aliyot Nashim LaTorah, on the permissibility of women to have a greater part in the ritual activities of the synagogue, having Aliyot and even reading the Torah. It was a long and detailed halachic disquisition which went into, which based itself on the sources, and it was very persuasive. That's not to say that everybody agreed with it, but it was very persuasive. Rav Henkin, who I regard as a very liberal and open-minded rabbi living in Eretz Israel, also a person of great independent thought, wrote an article in which he wrote that, also in Eda, a response in which he wrote that he thought that basically Mendel Shapiro's arguments were correct. There were some certain details that could be discussed and could be, should be qualified, that weren't completely convincing, but that any congregation that acts in this fashion would not be considered orthodox and would not be a part of the consensus. And this was something that I found unacceptable, in the sense that if the argument was correct, and if these people were doing something which was permissible according to Jewish law, and if he had argued the point in a persuasive manner, why should these congregations not be accepted in the consensus of orthodoxy? Furthermore, I think it was very wrong that they should be pushed outside the consensus and be pushed into the air, into the sphere of conservatism, and take up that sort of sense of identity, that they're leaving Orthodox Judaism. And I think the Orthodox Judaism should be, as far as possible, inclusive and not exclusive. Now, nowadays it's very difficult. These are very difficult tags. I mean, nowadays you have right-wing Orthodox, you have central Orthodox, you have modern Orthodox, you have Orthodox light, you have all these different sorts of things, and you don't quite know what's the border between right-wing conservatives and left-wing Orthodox or Orthodox light. And these are sort of little taviot, little tags which are becoming less and less clear and less, in a sense, less and less meaningful, but they have their political meaning. I then wrote an article in which I tried to support, bolster Mendel Shapiro's position, adding additional arguments which I thought, halachic arguments, which I thought strengthen the whole argument, and basing myself again on great authorities, including Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg in many of his tshuvot, in his attitude in his halachic approaches to certain issues, and you heard about him just before. And I said that I felt that it was incumbent upon the Orthodox community to make sure that these people, these women, who were completely genuine, it wasn't just some sort of feminist agenda, it was women who had studied Torah for years in the different midrashot, and they felt that they wanted this additional spiritual opportunity to enrich themselves. They should be given this opportunity, since I believed it was absolutely legitimate and permissible halachically, and they should be kept within the Orthodox orbit. And the truth is that this move or this trend is not a trend that's come from above. It's not because people have written articles saying that this is permissible, that this is good, that this is to be encouraged. It's come from below. The women started off with women's prayer groups just on Shabbos Mevorchim, and then they afterwards developed into these semi-egalitarian groups, and then they went to different rabbis and tried to work out further details of how to do it to remain within the parameters of normative halachic principles and so on and so forth, and they are developing these different congregations. And the truth is that there are more and more of them developing. I myself have been somehow involved, in the sense that I've been invited to speak upon this subject in certainly half a dozen communities in Israel, in Modi'in, in Tel Aviv, even in Bnei Brak. Not all these communities, congregations have actually taken off. Some of them were discussions among themselves and they weren't sure in which direction to go, and they had panels and they had to decide for themselves. In some cases there were communities that one doesn't want to split up. There are many different scenarios, but in the same way as there exists such kihilot, and they are at the moment marginal, both in the United States, in Darkei Noam, in New York, and in other such in KOE in New York, which is slightly different. So there are various Shira Chadasha type minyanim in Israel. I think that this is not a passing fad. One never knows. I think that this is something which will develop. There will be more and more of them. There will be struggles in the individual communities, and they will be ostracized in some social contexts. But if they have the strong motivation, the guts, and the staying power, then they will develop, and I believe they will flourish. Now, I don't think that they're going to be, in the near future, a major element. But I do think that they will not, in the next 10 years or so, they will no longer be really marginal. They'll become a part, I hope, of the accepted spectrum of Orthodox life. And whether they'll be considered on the periphery of Orthodox life or more central or not, that will depend on all sorts of other things. But the fact that these women are also studying Torah, and there are now Torahnot Rabbaniot, and there are now Yoatzot Rabbaniot, and there are now ladies who are even poskot, and there are institutions where the major teachers of Talmud and Halakha are women and not men, and they're teaching other women. It'll take a generation, because in our male world, to become a Talmid Chacham is not done in 5 years. It's done in 20 years or 30 years. You start at a young age and you continue in yeshiva for the next 10, 15 years. It takes a long time to develop. And there hasn't been that much time. But there will come a time when women will have studied long enough and in the right sort of framework and atmosphere. And I have no doubt that they have the mental and the cerebral abilities to achieve that sort of level of ability, and eventually there will be women who will be major personalities in the Torah world, in the Torah landscape. So it's a matter of time. I always say that it's better that these things evolve in an evolutionary fashion rather than in a revolutionary fashion. When you try to do things too quickly, you have a backlash, it becomes counterproductive, you have too much opposition. That is certainly the case in women's Torah studies. Women's Torah studies evolved slowly and developed only over the last 20 or 30 years to the proportions that they are nowadays, and it's enormously successful. There are many, many tens of thousands of women in Eretz Yisrael that are learning in over 40 different midrashot in scattered over Israel, learning Torah. There are probably more than that. And this is something that didn't exist 20 years ago. And one knows the history of this particular development within the modern Orthodox world. I'm not talking about Beit Yaakov, that's a totally different picture. So, yes, I am optimistic, I admit it, and I'm optimistic, but I don't see this as happening rapidly. I see it as evolving slowly, and I don't think it's going to peter out.
Rabbi Sperber, we're honored that you're with us today. Thank you very, very much.